This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and as with me as always are Nick and Becca and Mark.
Hey!
Hello!
Howdy!
We have a great episode for you this week. We are talking about The Crown of Axis, a new adventure that will be coming out for 13th Age by Wade Rocket. And it is going to be a unique sort of product in the fact that it will be a PDF-only product for 13th Age. Now, I've been working with Wade. I worked with him basically all last year to get this thing put together. It's in editing and layout. It's going to be a lot of fun. But before we get into it, this is a spoiler alert. If you are a player and your DM likes running adventures from 13th Age, don't listen or fake that you don't listen. Go listen to another review, another episode. Go listen to the Elven Towers review. It's been out for a while. But you will hear spoilers for the adventure. Now, what's interesting about this adventure, we're going to talk about it, that may not matter because Wade has done a great job of making this an introductory adventure. And his goal was basically for introductory adventures, these are the type of adventures that a GM would run multiple times with different groups. And he didn't want the GM to get bored. So this adventure is actually very unique. It's a lot like The Wreck of Volan's Glory, which we reviewed, I think, in season one, also by Wade Rocket, in the fact that every time you run it, it's going to be a different experience for everyone at the table. So that's your warning, players. Put your fingers in your ears. And GMs, pay attention. So this is an introductory adventure for 13th Age. What does that mean? It's designed, it's got hand-holding throughout in a good way. Like, it's got ideas for the GMs. If this is your first time running 13th Age, this is the go-to product. This is designed to be a go-to product that you can pick up. It's going to kind of explain things as you go through. And it's designed for first or second level. Found this game 13th Age. You want to play it. Here's an adventure. Here is a scenario for you. Now, Wade does give advice for upgrading it to Champion or Epic tier. What did you guys think of that advice? Would you keep it just as an adventurer tier idea, or would you think that it's very easy to expand upon it and drop it basically anywhere in your campaign?
I think it'd be pretty straightforward. I could see dropping it elsewhere in a campaign arc, but personally, I probably would keep it as an introductory adventure tier adventure, primarily because it's such a good launching point to a lot of other things. It's designed for first and second level characters. And so I would want to respect the initial design mechanisms and leverage it for that. It certainly can be ported to higher tiers, but I think by the time you get to that point, there's going to be enough other tier appropriate hooks and arcs that are going on that you wouldn't necessarily need to leverage something like this.
And if you need some ideas for what kind of adventures to launch out of Crown of Axis, go check out our last episode where we talk about the Emperor. And this is kind of a perfect foundation stone for any of those ideas.
I like it like this. And that's kind of the idea with making it repeatable and different. And we'll talk about the specifics and how you can do that. But just this is a good introductory so that you can come back and revisit. And it would help, I think, run this adventure tier so that when you're champion and epic and you need to come back and you need that contact, you've met them in this adventure because they have a lot of people in the different areas, districts in the city have people that you can meet in this adventure, which is perfect, I think.
Yeah. Becca, would you give us an overview of the Crown of Axis adventure?
Sure. All right. So the Crown of Axis adventure, it starts out, well, pretty simple. There is this gladiatorial ring or a coliseum that has been closed for quite some time, and they wish to reopen it in order to make money. The only problem is there are now things in the arena. And so you are sent in to clear the arena. However, although it starts simple and fairly straightforward, as your adventure progresses, you determine or you discover that not all is as it seems, mm-hmm. and it is not as straightforward as you might hope. And by the end, you've uncovered plots and schemes mm-hmm. and machinations of anyone, depending on iconic links to the group. And there is a possibility of Axis exploding, or Axis exploding, or Axis dying. And
That's all if it goes horribly wrong, right?
Right.
It's actually a pretty...
bad.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty epic hook for a first-level adventure. I think that Wade got a really good hook that feels like, hey, this is the stakes at level one. Just imagine what the stakes will be at level 10. Mm-hmm. Now, Becca brought up a good point. One of the ways this adventure is customizable is Wade has broken down, I think in a lot of ways, like Cal started doing. They grouped the icons that the players may be able to be connected with into categories, and depending on which category is strongest among your players, that actually affects the outcome of what is the plot for the adventure. Now, another, like the first part Becca brought up, you descend into the Warrens under the Crown of Axis, this Colosseum. Now, Wade did something really cool to make sure that this adventure is replayable. Mark, do you want to talk about how Wade has kind of designed the Warrens to be random so that even the GM is surprised?
Yeah, so one of the things is, and I love it, and I'm going to use it for other things, is the trouble tables. So as you're wandering around the Warrens, and you got to figure, I would treat this like an old, and I ran a playtest of this, and I think it was great. I ran it like an old school dungeon. You're exploring, you don't know what's there, but instead of having a map saying you rope open room 10 and there are 10 goblins in there, you have a trouble table and you roll on it. And the higher the number, the more things could happen. Because sometimes you open it and there's nothing there, and you run into these random, really random encounters with a different name, and like the trouble tables, and they're kind of keyed to the area that you're in. So it's not just, you know, roll a D100 and pick something on the list. They're keyed to the areas that you're in, but as you play through it, you could play through this again and not run into the same encounter or in the same place, which is, I think, just fantastic. And that's just on the small scale of the Warrens. And you can expand that for lots of things. You can put it in your city and make trouble tables of this is what you run into in the poor neighborhood or the merchant, you know, the market square. I think it's a great tool for GMs to use.
Yeah, if you remember the tension tables from Shards of a Broken Sky, these are much more... They're smaller. There's less likely to kind of have, as Mark said, kind of that feel of a sprawling, hey, nothing happens here, something weird happens here, nothing happens here. They're much more focused, and they're focused on each area. Becca and Nick, what did you think of the trouble tables?
I always like, as a GM, being able to randomly insert trouble, and that it's not always... here are bad guys, but here is a situation that you now have to deal with. I get the feeling that for a lot of people who play a lot of RPGs, it gets tiring to set out from a town to go to another town and, oh, you failed your survival check while you encounter a party of goblins. In these tables, you're trying to get from room to room, you encounter something, and it's not always just a party of goblins. You don't have to fight your way through everything. I always appreciate that.
I liked it. I liked two things. One, the fact that the tables were relatively simple. Like they were not a sprawling list of tables. You got to roll on this one and then roll on that one and then roll on that one. Is just with a couple quick rolls, you've got the room ready to go. So it was the simplicity of it was, I think, a really good asset to a GM running it. I also like the tables in the sense that they are what help make this an adventure that you would want to play again and again as a GM. Yeah. And I think, too, that the tables are also something that as you're gauging how much time has been passing at the table and how much time you have in the overall session, you can also make some adjustments with that as well. Perhaps you don't roll on the trouble table because you know that you need to hit a certain point by a certain time in order to complete the entire arc by the end of your session. But it's a very adaptable piece of this adventure.
Now, I will point out one of the Wade definitely seemed to have written this for a theater of the mind, So there are advice on how to, if you want to run a theater of the mind, run it as is. If you need something more concrete for your table, there's a lot of advice on, hey, here's the terrain. Here's how monsters interact with the terrain. Here's kind of what's in the room. So you have both options available. But there are a ton of new monsters in this adventure as well. Like, we've got clockworks, we've got thieves, we've got soldiers of Axis and mercenaries, and there's a lot of really fun monster design happening in this space. All right, so once you clear the warrens, as Becca said, everything's simple. You get paid, you go on. Well, actually, now things get interesting because someone wants to kill the adventurers. And trying to find out why that is going on, Wade has come up with another set of rules for how this works. And it's essentially an investigative montage. Now, we've talked a lot about montages, how to introduce NPCs, how to handle travel. It's sort of a 13th age staple. Do one of you guys want to go over what an investigative montage, like how those would work?
And to tell you the truth, as I got through running this and I got to that point, I'm like, wait a minute, am I running Shadowrun? The players get backstabbed? It was a complete thrill because I've never run into that in a more traditional, you know, D20 type of game that, like, what? But it's great because if you're familiar with montages where it's player-led, in this case, you would go to a player like Nick and say, okay, what's the question that you want to ask? What thing are you looking for? And then you say, okay, where would you find that answer? Well, I would find that in Rabble Ward, for an example. Okay, now who specifically in Rabble Ward do you talk to get that information? And as a GM, as the players are, this is very great as a GM, as they're giving this information, you just take notes. This information was found in Rabble Ward by this character talking to head of the Thieves Guild. And the players give you that information. And once that's found, then you go around the table to the next player and they can play off the question or come up with a new one. And again, and you can also, with this, you have what he called the heat die, where as you're investigating, people are noticing. And so the tension ratchets up and something might happen. So you use your escalation die with this as they're doing their investigation until something happens and then you reset it and keep going. But then they get kind of a clue to the players that someone's paying attention, that you're asking all these questions in these different districts.
I really like the idea of the investigative montage because it allows the players to determine what is actually important to them. A lot of times when you are looking for information, you're kind of, as a player, you're limited by the information a GM has. And you ask, I want to look for this, and the GM either says, okay, you find information about that, or, well, you don't, because that's not actually important. So I like the player autonomy in having an investigative montage so that they think, this is important. Okay, it is. How would you go about finding that? It allows for the yes and aspect of role playing.
I do also like that they give you a list of clues ready-made to give to the players. So you're not having to try to come up with them on your own. It's like, okay, here's, you want to go find out questions about this? Then here's the clues you're going to end up with. I would explore the idea of maybe having the players, in addition or as a part of this montage, also roll a background check to determine how effective their search was and leverage how many clues they get based off of that. You know, if they get a 6+, then they get 3 clues. Or if they beat 6+, they get 1 clue. If they beat 11+, 2 clues. Something like that, just to kind of give the dice a little bit more of a play in that. But and you could also opt to maybe include some red herrings or some false clues if you want to draw this out. You know, if this seems to be the highlight of the arc for the players, then lean into this and draw this out for as long as you want to.
The final battle is kind of the players figure out what's going on. They figure out who's behind them. And Wade is actually given like 3 different final battles. So depending on, like, it's always going to be the 2 big villains. But then also depending on how the players interact with the investigation and what's going on, the final battle could actually have a bunch of additional threats in that thing, which I thought, like, at every point, Wade has made this an adventure that you could run multiple times over and over again.
Well, when I was able to playtest this final battle, one of the players in my group had determined that one of the bad guys was hunky hunky, and boy, did she want some. And it led to a very interesting set of fights, and that I don't think any of us were quite expecting it to go down that way. But I did really appreciate the fact that as we went into this, stuff we had heard and found out in the montage was supported. This guy really is a bad guy, and that guy really is a mook for him. And, mm-hmm. oh, these people, you thought they were the bad guys, but it's really those guys. And so I appreciated that you can, yeah, adjust how your battle goes down based on the investigation.
And we also had, we didn't talk about the gladiatorial, the grand opening, where players can actually participate as gladiators, or if you want to just sit back and observe and do player things, and we're looking at you, Rogue, running around doing rogue things, you let the players, almost like a montage, describe the gladiatorial fights and what happens and who wins if they don't want to actually participate, but they can participate if they'd like to. So that's another scene that the players can do. I'm thinking a lot of people would be interested. Yeah, I could be a gladiator.
Well, I think that brings up a really good point in the fact that even if you don't plan on running this adventure, between the new monsters, the rules for investigation montages, and the rules for gladiator combat, I mean, those are three little subsystems, if you will, that make the PDF worthwhile for any 13th Age GM. There's a ton of new monsters in here. Did anything stand out as like, this is something I definitely want to use, and why?
When I ran it, the character of Inforestus, we'll just call it the character of Inforestus, mm-hmm. grew bounds and leaps beyond what Wade, I think, designed, and became a major player. That character really took off and hit a chord with the group. If we continued it, it would be interesting to see what happened in Axis with this character. You'll see when you run it there, GMs.
Yeah, that is a key fight there in the warrants.
I liked the stats that were provided for adversaries. Because again, if your players are anything like mine, they will insult people. And the next thing you know, you have someone who's adversarial to your players. And so being able to throw a quick, I mean, not a monster at this point, but a enemy at your players, especially one that they've insulted, it's nice to just kind of have that. And I don't have to try to make a whole new thing, because my players are known for talking well with the NPCs.
Now, again, this is one of those things that Wade flavored, because you get a bunch of different abilities based off the icon. So if Becca's players come up with this NPC from the Prince of Shadows and they piss him off, and I can attest to being in Becca's group and watching this happen, going, but it was a friendly old gnome. Suddenly it's not just the adversary, but you get to add special abilities for the icons that they're associated with.
Yeah, so it gives them a nice flavor, as well as going, okay, this was a weak adversary. He wanted to stand up to you guys, but he's just weaker than you. Or you guys stepped into something that was much stronger than you expected, and you got knocked flat on your butt.
A couple of the monsters that I really liked that I would be keen on bringing them into other 13th Age games as well are the Skitter Lizards and Skullface. And the reason is because that both of those have options for extending that encounter beyond just that one combat scene. The Skitter Lizards, the fact that there are advice given on how a player could adopt them as a companion, mm-hmm. I thought that was fantastic. And for Skullface, I think it's a great concept for a recurring kind of minor threat that could kind of pervade through the entire thing. and even the skitter lizards, their hiss ability for all lizards. I mean, that's something that players could potentially gain a benefit from an icon relationship even before they go into that encounter. Those two really stood out to me as top notch.
I really like the fact that Wade, for a lot of these monsters, gives advice to the GM on how to encourage players to use their icon relationships to affect the fight. So he'll say, if you're in this fight and you have this kind of icon relationship, tell the player that they can use it to do this. And it really kind of gets the players in the mindset of, I need to be spending these resources, and here's how I can do it. I think one of my favorite is the Emberhill Noble. They literally wrote the book on the classical text of war in the Dragon Empire. So they have an ability that on a natural even hit or miss, they have a list of like aphorisms from this text on the art and science of war. And you get to pick it every time they roll a natural even hit, they gain different bonuses. So the GM has a lot of options, even with just this one monster, that fight will never necessarily be the same. Now, before we wrap it up, the last thing I want to talk about is the art. So the cover you can go check out on Pelgrane's website. The cover is great. It's this amazing painting of a gladiator fight. But all of the interior art is done by Simmy of Doom. We'll put a link in the show notes to her Instagram and her Twitter. She is we at Iconic love working with Simmy. She did all the art for the Torg and Fading Suns group. She has done a bunch of art commissions for us. It was really fun to be able to work with her on this, especially because it is a PDF product. We're doing splashes of color. So it's not just the black and white line art that you may be familiar with her. It's much more like the stuff that we see on her Instagram or her Twitter, where it's these very clean lines and then like beautiful accent colors to kind of really make the piece pop. Like the skull face piece is so good. If I remember correctly, like the only two things that are, yeah. So it's this black and white image of this leader of the Thieves Guild in the Warrens. But the skull face mask and her iconic razor are both just this gold color. And it really pops. What did you guys think about the art?
I liked the subtle use of color. I thought that the fact that there was only select pieces that were actually colorized versus black and white really did a lot to emphasize the important parts of that image, as well as kind of draw you in what else might be going on. It's like a taste. And really drew me in. I loved it.
Yeah, I like the style. I like her style of characters. There's some artists that are, I would say all artists out there putting stuff out are great, but I really like her style, her especially even black and white. I like it a lot.
Mm-hmm. I will always champion Simmy. I think she's just wonderful. And when I have been able to commission stuff from her, she's been lovely. And so to see these pieces, I agree with the splash of color. It draws you in to see green flames or to see a blue tower, and you go, okay, well, what actually does that mean? Like, what does that signify? So yeah, I thought the art was just lovely, and especially when you see some of the art for the more important villains in this book, you get the sinister feel that they're trying to go for.
Well, any final thoughts on this adventure? It sounds like we all really enjoyed it. I've been more quiet because I did a bunch of development work on it, so I'm very partial to it. Any final thoughts before we wrap up this episode?
I think once I get my hands on the final product, this is definitely going to become one of those go-to adventures that I run for 13th Age players. I recommend for new GMs to run too.
So in 2 weeks, we'll be back. We're going to be looking at the Foundry, a new virtual tabletop that has 13th Age support. So until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, stay gaming.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.